C-98. Port-au-Français Research Station, Le Grand Terre, Kerguelen Islands. Over 2,000 miles from the nearest civilian population base, Billy Kendrick and the tourists under his watch sat in a quiet dining hall awaiting the arrival of their main breakfast course. The local delicacy of scurvy-busting Kerguelen cabbage had gone down well in a warming soup, with Billy's excited tourists listening to his expertly delivered stories and theories as they ate. Billy, a once-respected archaeologist who had long ago turned his back on an academic world he deemed guilty of rejecting reality for simplicity's sake, became well known to the public as a self-styled disclosure activist during a decade spent trying to expose what he saw as the greatest cover-up of all time, the cover-up pertaining to government knowledge of intelligent extraterrestrial life. Popular and affable, Billy was more delighted than anyone when Dan McCarthy's initial bravery eventually led to the discovery of the spherical alien artifact, which forced the government to admit a truth he had long held as self-evident. The precise timing of the moment when President Slater reluctantly spoke the four magic words, "We are not alone," had been utterly perfect for Billy, coinciding as it did with his E.T. weekender in Myrtle Beach. That event's festivities had attracted tens of thousands of enthusiastic supporters, but the organizational headaches which lay behind its success paled in comparison to those Billy had encountered when planning his latest and most ambitious venture yet. The tourist group Billy was currently regaling with Kerguelen-related trivia and anecdotes from various stages in his colorful life had already been traveling with him for over a week, and they had plenty of time left before their great tour came to an end. Ever since Disclosure Day, as it had naturally come to be known, the locations mentioned in the documents which led to the modern rediscovery of an alien sphere off the coast of Argentina had become some of the most desirable tourist destinations in the world. Billy's tour began gently enough at Lake Toplitz in the Australian Alps, which Hans Kloster's infamous handwritten letter had pinpointed as the site where an alien craft was discovered by Nazi officials in April of 1938. The second stage involved a very short and very pleasant journey to Salzburg, where an alien artifact had recently been rediscovered in a storage locker belonging to the late Karl Heilig, an amateur treasure hunter and prominent archaeologist who Billy had known of professionally, but not personally. From there, each of Billy's groups proceeded to Lake Namtso in Tibet, where an alien sphere was said to have levitated from the water and into the arms of the expedition team sent to find it following Kloster's successful decoding of a map found in the alien craft. Trips to the three remaining sites of the Nazis' sphere discoveries then followed, beginning with a voyage to Kerguelen before the tour groups ventured as close as reasonably possible to the inhospitable Antarctic coastal area once known as New Swabia, and continued on to the tiny southern island of Bouvette. The great tour concluded in the coastal Argentine city of Miramar, where the famous sphere, which contained two world-changing artifacts, had been lifted from the ocean just over a year ago, some 70 years after a surrendering U-boat crew was said to have dumped it in the ocean in order to ensure it never fell into Allied hands. Each of Billy's groups contained 120 tourists, 40 of whom enjoyed a full-day land tour of Kerguelen during each of their first 3 days docked at the remote island. He told his adventurous and wealthy tourists to make the most of their time on dry land, since landings at Bouvette, their next port of call after passing New Swabia, were notoriously challenging and rare, typically requiring helicopter transportation from the ship. And although Billy had fought hard to overcome countless obstacles in arranging his ambitious Great Tour project, his insurer's refusal to cover any terrestrial activities on Bouvette Island ultimately spelled an end to his hope of including a land expedition in the itinerary. This mattered more to Billy than his tourists, who knew that the island was uninhabited anyway, and that the established history held that a Nazi crew had found the Bouvette sphere while conducting tests around the island rather than on it. Billy's eyes and body regularly drifted towards a large window during his breakfast time talk, as he never tired of the bizarre island's sights, The area immediately outside was relatively flat, in stark contrast to the eye-catchingly harsh peaks and rolling landscapes which defined other areas of Grande Terre. But there was something magical about the island that made Kerguelen the place Billy always looked forward to returning to most of all. In Billy's eyes, it was a one-of-a-kind destination worthy of all the attention it had recently garnered and more. One relatively trivial novelty which proved popular for tourist photographs were the warning signs at areas where animals regularly crossed over marked roads. Tourists took delight in posing next to these signs because the animal inside the red triangle was not a deer, nor even a bear, but rather a large seal. To some, this was symbolic of Kerguelen, home of one idiosyncrasy after another. To the surprise of many, there were deer on the remote southern island, several thousand reindeer to be precise. Following their introduction along with sheep and the less welcome proliferation of ravenous rabbits and seabird-troubling cats. Billy's tourists, meanwhile, were always warmly welcomed by most of the island's research staff. Billy was respectful in ensuring that his tourists behaved impeccably, while the money he brought in had aided many researchers by enabling upgrades to their aging equipment and transport vehicles. By far the least welcome Kerguelen residents were another group of recent arrivals, several dozen staff representing the Global Space Commission. The GSC had initially formed as the Global Shield Commission when the opening of the Argentine Sphere revealed two engraved plaques, whose messages many perceived as warnings against the imminent arrival of a hostile alien race or a threat from an incoming asteroid. When the third plaque almost entirely quashed these fears upon its discovery in Salzburg, the GSC's politically shrewd chairman, William Godfrey, wasted no time in rechristening the young organization as the Global Space Commission in a successful bid to maintain its relevance. Under Godfrey's leadership, the GSC brought the Earth's powerful nations together, pooling their resources in pursuit of a truly collaborative, brave new era of space research. The past year had seen a tremendous centralization of decision-making power, with all national space administrations soon to be confined to history and full integration procedures well underway. With an orange GSC flag now the only one flying over Port-au-Français, a handful of self-important GSC observers were never far from view. These observers were officially there to oversee the operations of staff from France's National Center for Space Studies, who had conducted research on Kerguelen for decades without the need for such oversight. But given the highly visible GSC deployments at every location linked to the alien revelations, including at Lake Nanso, where no space-related research had ever been conducted prior to their own arrival, this official line fell apart under even the slightest of scrutiny. The GSC observers had always stayed out of Billy's way, and he had always made sure to stay out of theirs. He told a few jokes at their organization's expense every now and then, which usually raised smiles on the faces of his tourists and drew stronger laughter from the station staff, who understandably harbored intense resentment towards the outsiders who recorded their movements and activities as if they were convicts, rather than dedicated researchers. After one particularly barbed joke about William Godfrey, Billy saw several of his tourists' faces react in visible shock. "Come on, it wasn't that bad," he chuckled. But even as he spoke, the way the expressions of shock spread around the room told him that they were reacting to something else. Within another second or two, Billy noticed a change in the room's light. At that moment, he turned to the window behind him, and at the very next, he ran towards the door, immediately calling everyone to follow as quickly as they could. Outside, Billy Kendrick and his lucky tourists gazed up in awestruck silence at what was by far the most incredible thing any of them had ever seen. An impossibly bright fireball in the crystal clear sky above Kerguelen. The doors of other nearby buildings were thrown open and slammed closed as people ran out to see the incredible meteor streaking its way across the morning sky. As almost all of the tourists reached into their pockets to grab their phones in an attempt to capture some all-important selfies with the mesmerizing meteor in the background, only Billy and a few others were paying full attention at the most spectacular moment of all. The moment when the meteor exploded in an unfathomably powerful airburst. The screams began quickly, in reaction to the flash blindness some experienced when a previously beautiful sight in the sky suddenly gave way to a near-total flash, which appeared dozens of times brighter than the sun. The medics stationed on Kerguelen and the doctors on Billy's ship were in for a busy day, but no one would have any lasting problems. After the flash, a smoky trail developed in the sky. Many tourists understandably ran inside in a natural defensive reaction to the tremendous explosion, but Billy stood in astonishment at the beautiful moment which had been bestowed upon him. Billy knew his history. He knew his impact events, and he knew his bolides. All bolides, exploding meteors, were spectacular sights to behold. But observing a bolide of this magnitude? Well, that was stupendously rare. Like everyone else on Kerguelen, Billy also knew that he was slap-bang in the middle of nowhere, somewhere between Antarctica and Madagascar, and countless miles from anyone else. The odds of seeing something like this were astronomically long, and the odds of seeing something like this somewhere like this were even longer. But for it to happen while Billy was in this specific somewhere like this, not just any tiny island where he was only spending a few days, but one so central to the world-changing events surrounding Dan McCarthy's leak and the long-overdue disclosure it brought about. Well, to Billy's mind, there weren't enough digits in a telephone number for those kinds of odds. And then came the sonic boom, after what he thought must have been comfortably more than a full minute. The majority of the few tourists who had so far remained at Billy's side now hastily fled for shelter, even more understandably running from a near-deafening sound which could easily have been mistaken for a heavy bombardment. One tourist with whom Billy had grown friendly during the preceding week, Janice, a retired lawyer from New Zealand, walked slowly to his side. The woman, still shielding her tender eyes despite the fireball's smoky trail being all that was left, had one simple question for the guide whose intellect and instincts she trusted greatly.
What the hell was that?
A serene smile spread across Billy's face.
Janice, my friend, that was them.